From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Everyone's feeling lucky these days, standing in line at their convenience stores, throwing down $2 for their Powerball ticket. With a $1.5 billion jackpot, there are a lot of dreams out there. But the odds of winning are 1 in almost 300 million. We are more likely to be killed by a vending machine or become president than we are to win the Powerball prize. We know that, but still, we play. Why? This hour on Point, human psychology, the dream of hitting the jackpot, and why we play the lottery. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on Are You In? Are You Dreaming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me first today from Los Angeles is Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. You can link to his latest column on Powerball at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Hiltzik, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
It's good to be here, Tom.
The sum is so big, it's kind of mind-boggling, and this is not, you remind us, by accident. They changed the way the whole thing works to get the bigger pot. How do they do that?
Well, that's right, Tom. The people who manage Powerball understood that big jackpots are what bring in the customers. But what they did was they basically increased the pool of numbers that are selected by customers to win, and that increased the odds. That made it less likely that any single jackpot would be won, which allowed them to increase the jackpot for subsequent drawings. And that's how we got to $1.5 billion.
And is that working? They just did it last fall. Are they having bigger jackpots since they made the change?
Well, they were looking ahead to a possible jackpot of $1 billion. So I think we have to say it was working. They understood that over a longer period, let's say over 5 years, the chances of a $1 billion jackpot would be much, much greater than they had been under the old rules. And I'm not sure that they expected it to happen this quickly, but here it is. So they were right.
Sales were down 19% in 2014 because they didn't have major jackpots, down 44% in New York. That's a huge decline. Is that turning around with this mega jackpot?
Well, I think the figures that we're seeing are that sales have just gone through the roof, as one would expect. Certainly here in California, I think as of now, they've brought in as many ticket sales for Powerball thus far this year than they did all last year. So something's happened. The magic is happening, if that's what you want to call it.
You are no fan of this. A lot of people clearly are. They're voting with their $2 or their $200 or their $2,000. I'm reading your Beverly Hills people out your way in Los Angeles putting in thousands for tickets. But you call this an even bigger ripoff than before. What do you mean, Michael?
Well, there are two ways it's a bigger ripoff. One is, of course, that the chances of winning are just minuscule, and the second way is that it's a much bigger jackpot. It's not that I'm not a fan of it. I understand the fun. Certainly, jackpots of this nature bring a lot of people out to buy tickets who would not have participated in this lottery at all. I think the issue that I have, that many others have with it, is that it's essentially a tax on poorer people who play these games much more frequently, spend much more money on it than the middle class or upper middle class or affluent people. And this is to fund functions of the government that really should be paid for out of taxes, that should be paid for by wealthier members of our society so that they're bearing their fair share.
It's kind of stunning when you look at the numbers on that front. Low-income households spend maybe $200, $300 on this. Those with less than $10,000 in income spending almost $600 versus an average American household spending $162. It really is the poorer reaches of society disproportionately buying in here in a bigger way.
That's right. And those are figures. The figures that you cited came from a paper that was done in 1999. So the figures may have changed, but the pattern certainly has stayed the same. And I think many researchers have found that lotteries in particular really do draw more heavily from lower socioeconomic strata.
Is it a big deal for American schools? That's what we always hear. It helps pay for the schools. How does it do that? Where does it do that?
Well, the way I characterize it is that it's essentially window dressing. It's a way to rationalize the fact that government is sponsoring a gambling game. In California, I think the schools are due a couple of billion dollars a year from the California lottery, but that really only comes to a percent or two of the California schools budget. So it looks like a big number, but in terms of the budgets, in terms of the money that's really required to run these educational systems, it's a pittance.
Are you surprised when you see people lining up to like crazy to get these tickets?
Well, not really. Look, I understand the power of publicity. I understand the power of a potentially big jackpot. For many people, certainly in my neighborhood, this is essentially a painless, frictionless transaction. They go into a convenience store or another retailer. They plunk down a couple of bucks. My wife has bought a couple of tickets. She just informed me. It doesn't really matter. Nobody really expects to win, at least among the people I know. But it's a little bit of fun. But it really is this big number. Once you get over $1 billion, you're going to get millions of people who say, well, why not? It's only a couple of bucks.
Here's one Powerball ticket buyer telling CBS reporter Juliana Goldman what he would do with the money if he should win.
I'm going to probably buy a big, giant mansion and dig a big moat all the way around it and let people in as I raise the bridge.
A big mansion with a big moat all the way around it, and you might need it with that kind of money. Here's another. Two Powerball ticket buyers with plans for their potential windfall.
I'm going to retire. Instantly.
Everybody says charity, right? Well, I'm not going to give it to charity. No.
I'm going to retire instantly and forget about everybody else. Michael Hiltzik, standby in Los Angeles. With me right now in the studio is On Point intern Maeve Pagess. She is what works checkout, has all through college at Upper Falls Discount Liquors in Newton, Massachusetts, and sees a lot of people coming through buying these Powerball tickets. Maeve, thanks for sitting down with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you've been working checkout here since you were 18 years old, all the way through college. You're still out there doing it. And have you seen the bigger traffic this week as this number has climbed and climbed?
Oh, without a doubt. People who don't usually buy tickets are buying tickets just because they can.
So of the people who are coming through with whatever it is, a six-pack of beer or whatever, what portion do you think are buying tickets as they buy their product at this point?
Anywhere from 50 to 75%, I would say. I don't have an exact number, but of far more than usual.
And what's their expression as they do it? They're like, oh, yeah, throw it in there, or I'm going to get it. This is mine. I'm dreaming. Or what are you hearing as they get these tickets?
I usually hear a lot of, oh, I never do this, or how do I do this? I want to get the Powerball tickets. Or people who do know what they're doing will talk about, ironically, I think, talk about what they would do with the money should they get it. But I haven't heard anyone say, I'm definitely going to get it.
Maeve Pagess there, working as a checkout clerk at a liquor store where a lot of people are buying these tickets. Michael Hiltzik, people are putting down big money for these, but the sort of game theorists say, look, the odds of winning are so small that it barely makes sense to put down $50 instead of $2 here.
That's right. Look, you can game this any way you want. I've certainly seen estimates about how much you have to spend if you want to have a significant chance of winning. I think those are very complicated calculations. Game theorists, other experts know that there are two components to our assessments as human beings of risk. One is the probability of something happening, and the second is the consequence if it does happen. And this is why, and people are very bad at estimating probabilities, but they're sensitive to big numbers. And that's why we're always very concerned about airline crashes, because even though the likelihood of being one is vanishingly small, but you know that if it happens, hundreds of people may lose their lives. This is the same thing, except with a great benefit at the far end. People don't think about their particular chances of winning the Powerball lottery, but they do think about what they would do with the money, as we just heard. And I think the lottery officials really are counting on that mismatch of the way we think about risk and probability and the way we think about a life-changing event like winning the lottery.
Maeve, can you see people dreaming as they plunk their couple bucks down or 20 bucks down on these tickets?
Oh, definitely. People always, the number one thing is, if I win, I'll come back and give you something. and they definitely have notions of what they would do. Some people don't know what they would do.
I think part of what people are going for here is just that dreaming that you do between the time you buy the ticket and the time the numbers come out.
Without a doubt. I don't think there's too many people who think they're definitively going to get it, but it's nice to dream about it.
And there it is, again and again in that line. Maeve Pagès, our intern who's watching it, who picked up our pool ticket for the whole staff here. Oh, boy. We'll see who shows up for work after we win, but then everybody's going to be a winner here, right?
Definitely.
So, or not. Maeve, thanks for sitting down with us
for a couple of minutes.
Michael, do the California revenue people look at this and say, you know, okay, it's only 1 or 2% of the budget, but it's a big deal to us? Or who pushes this so hard if it's not that big a portion of state budgets?
Well, certainly the lottery establishment, the lottery bureaucracy pushes this. The California Lottery is a heavy advertiser on all media. They are basically doing what's natural for them to do, which is promote it. And the idea that the money is going through education does tend to take some of the bite off the idea that the government is sponsoring. Not only is the government sponsoring gambling, but it's sponsoring gambling that really is directed at poorer people and working people. That's why the idea was to designate this money for education. And most other states have done the same thing. But as I said, it's essentially window dressing. Look, this is an enterprise that the state runs. It does bring in revenue. There's no two ways about it. And the idea that it's going to this great cause basically does enable them to rationalize something that for many people is essentially a sin.
But a whole lot of people in that pool this week, in particular with that very big number out there. We're going to come back and look at the human psychology here. We'll talk with a financial planner from the Sudden Money Institute about what to do if lightning strikes you. Michael Hiltzik, please stand by in Los Angeles. Maeve Pagès, On Point intern extraordinaire, thanks for coming in and talking with us for a few minutes today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the super lottery prize on the table now, the $1.5 billion Powerball jackpot, the dreams and craziness and psychology of the national frenzy around it, the good, the bad, the ugly, the funny, and what to do if you win it. Sure. That's going to happen. You can join us this hour. Have you bought a ticket? How do you feel about it? Do you feel crazy when the odds are so long, or is it worth it just for the lark, the daydreaming, the office camaraderie? And what's the conversation like at home or with friends when you think of what if the win was yours? Michael Hiltzik is with us, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. His headline, not real enthusiastic, how the Powerball rules were tweaked to make the game an even bigger ripoff. Here's the Powerball drawing from Saturday night. It was already just about a billion, and people were already on pins and needles about it.
Historic jackpot, record-breaking ticket sales, and it all comes down to this. Good evening, America. I'm Sam Marlin. Tonight's jackpot has climbed up to a record-breaking estimated $949.8 million. I hope you have your Powerball tickets. Good luck. Let's see how you did. First number down tonight, 32.
Hard to resist, and many, many Americans have not. Last fall, Julie Leach did not resist. Three Rivers, Michigan, she won a $310 million Powerball jackpot back in September. A pittance, a mere pittance compared to $1.5 billion. She was on her lunch break from her job at a fiberglass factory when she found out.
Well, I might as well check my numbers while I'm sitting here waiting for my lunch. And that's when I realized that I was the winner. I didn't believe it. I had to go back to work and get verified from a couple other coworkers, and just couldn't believe it.
Are you leaving your job? What are your plans now?
Oh, I quit automatically.
Are you leaving your job automatically? Tom and Kathy Rio won a $70 million Powerball jackpot in July. At a press conference, Kathy shared how they would spend some of their winnings.
We always thought that when we retired, we'd get an RV and travel. Now I think we can travel without the RV.
But of course, most overwhelmingly do not win, and the burden of all that ticket purchasing falls most heavily or is most eagerly embraced by those with the fewest resources in this country. Michael Hiltzik, please stand by in Los Angeles. Frank Farley joins us right now as well from Philadelphia, professor of psychology at Temple University, former president of the American Psychological Association. Frank Farley, thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here, Tom.
What's the psychology of this? We know the odds are so long. We heard on Morning Edition the other day, something like if you stacked pennies as big as the Empire State Building, to win this, you'd have to choose the right penny out of that stack. That makes it sound utterly, nearly impossible, and yet we do it. Why, Frank?
Well, think of a recipe. There are no psychological things, no behaviors that are due to just one thing. So it's always a recipe with a variety of ingredients. And so one person may buy the ticket with one particular recipe that's motivating them. Another one may have a slightly different recipe. But I think that, you know, in this case, it's the big thing, because of the total improbabilities of success, is fun. You know, I think it's kind of a thrill ride. I think there are a whole set of things, but fun would be at the top of my list. That it's a thrill, it's exciting, it's fun, and I think that's one. Another one is optimism. You know, the pessimists won't be playing this, and so you know, there's a strong psychology of hope here. And you know, I think this thing is way too big, and I don't like it. I think, you know, much smaller Powerballs, and you know. So that more people are winners would be a much healthier system. But the brief moment of hope, that sort of brief injection of hope when you think you're going to win, that's not bad. You know, we need hope in this world. And another psychological feature is what we could call intermittent reward. If you've played lotteries in the past, you might have won one of them, and then played two or three more times and won nothing, and then you won again. And so you're getting this kind of intermittent reward. And so that could bring you into this particular Powerball, because you might think, well, it's my turn now. You know, I've lost the last three, but now I'm going to win. So that we would call intermittent reward. And another thing that may hinted at is what I call the Mount Everest motive. You know, it's just too big to ignore. I mean, it's huge. And, you know, Mallory, when he attempted to summit Mount Everest, and he was asked why would he do that, you know, the record is 1 in 4 people die summiting Everest. He said, because it's there. And so this one is just so huge. It's just too big to not be part of it. And another factor is what one might call emotional contagion. You know, the kind of excitement maybe among your friends or family, and they're so excited about it that you get excited about it, and that motivates you to go in and buy one or more tickets. Conformity could be another one. Mm-hmm. You simply are conforming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And another one, a very current motive that we see all over the internet, is what we call FOMO, F-O-M-O. Fear of missing out. You know, people constantly checking their text messages, their emails, you know, this fear of missing out on something, something that's happening in the world, or something's happening with a friend or an acquaintance, etc. And so I think that would be motivating some people, just the fear of not being involved. And that might be particularly strong, Tom, in your office pool, you know.
Or every office pool.
Every office pool. I mean, what if the pool won and you weren't in it?
Right.
So that's the ultimate fear of missing out.
Even though the odds are so long. Michael Hiltzik, that's quite a menu. And when you hear all that menu of psychological motivations at work here, it almost sounds surprising that not everybody does it. Those things work on the human psyche, Michael.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that the professor mentioned that really struck me, look, I've covered the gaming industry from time to time, and you have to tip your hat to these guys. They are experts at human psychology. This is how, when you go to Vegas, you really get drawn into the idea of gaming. When the Powerball people changed the rules, they not only made the ultimate jackpot harder to win so that it could be built up over time, they also made the chump change winnings, that's the $4 minimum win, much easier to win. And that's what keeps people coming. You have a better chance of getting something, you know, what the professor called the intermittent win. So you have a better chance of winning $4. That keeps you coming back. And in fact, I would suspect that many of the winners of the $4 prizes or of scratchers in some of the other games. They just crank that money back into new tickets. They're at the counter. They just say, oh, yeah, give me a couple of tickets for this $4 win, and the tickets are $2. But that really is a way that the Powerball organizers consciously do. They know their business, let's face it. And they know how to play on the psychology of punters, essentially.
We're going to hear in a minute from Susan Bradley of the Sutton Money Institute. Just think about that name for a minute, and maybe you buy another ticket. I don't know. We've got a lot of callers and questions for the two of you. Masha in Boston. Masha, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have got two things. One is a comment. I really identify with the emotional contagion thing that your guest said. You know, the idea that it's all over my Facebook, my friends talking about how they stood there picking out their numbers and fantasizing about how they're going to win. And the other question I have is, when people do win, how do they take care of their personal safety? Because when you have all this publicity saying that you just won millions of dollars and it's all over the news,
yeah,
I could think that that would be a really dangerous situation. And in fact, so my own sort of journey with this is, you know, I told my husband yesterday, we got to get some tickets because, like, you know, oh, this is just so exciting, and I wanted to be part of the excitement. And then while we were thinking about what we would do with the money, I was like, okay, would I need to stop using the tea and, you know, hire a chauffeur? And how do you know you could trust the chauffeur?
And pretty soon you're in a nightmare scenario with your $1 billion.
Yeah.
Oh, Masha, let us look at that. Frank, you can hear, I mean, it's not just the upside. It's amazing the extent people elaborate these fantasies of the win. On the positive, you know, the ranch and the beach house and what you'd give to this person and that. But also the down, right? Masha's already imagining her security needs once she wins the $1.5 billion.
Powerball-fueled paranoia.
Yes.
It could be a new diagnostic category.
Of course, the thing is, Michael, we don't just go to happy movies. We also go to scary movies. And that fun that Frank's talking about, the movie we sort of run in our minds for the day or two between buying the ticket and losing, can have all kinds of opulence in it, but also maybe that weird, pleasant sensation of imagined fear.
Well, that's true, and I think there's certainly a lot of people who are playing the Powerball lottery who would say, you know, I'm not going to change the way I live. I enjoy my life. It'll be nice to have. But I also want to point out that the organizers of the public lotteries also understand some of these concerns, and they understand that these are not imaginary concerns, that they can be real problems for winners of these lotteries. And going back years when the jackpots were much smaller, I think a lot of the states that were setting these up also provided advice and counseling to their winners, because they understood that the downside of something being a life-changing event is that you change your life in ways that you're really not equipped to deal with. And I think we may be hearing from one of these, from an expert in how to manage the funds down the line. But these are not imaginary concerns. They can be real, and they can be a problem for a lot of people.
We hear all the tales of woe that come to people once they've won, but still, we throw in our couple bucks, or maybe a lot more than that. I'm looking here at the Dallas News. They talked with Mark Cuban, who owns the Mavericks there, about his advice. If you win this mega Powerball, he says, first, hire a tax attorney. Second, don't take the lump sum. So says Mark Cuban. You don't want to blow it all in one spot. He says, if you weren't happy yesterday, you won't be happy tomorrow. It's money. It's not happiness. But he says, if you were happy yesterday, you're going to be a lot happier tomorrow. It's money. Life gets easier when you don't have to worry about the bills. I want to look at the money side of this for a minute with Susan Bradley. She joins us now from West Palm Beach, Florida, financial planner, founder of the Sutton Money Institute. They train financial advisors and professionals about transitions in financial life. Susan Bradley, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We love the name of your outfit there, the Sutton Money Institute. Are you the net that's supposed to catch all the lottery winners, or that's about coming into it anyway, I guess?
Well, we would like to offer guidance to them because it is, it's as hard as you've been talking about. You know, it's big money, and when money changes, life changes, and change is not necessarily easy, but it can be done.
Okay, Susan, so I need your advice. I'm pretty sure I'm going to win this thing. They say $1.5 billion. What do I need to know? If my number comes up, what do I need to know? What do I need to do?
Well, first of all, you need to change your cell phone. So you need to get a
cell phone. Yeah, but that's the number everybody gets me at.
That's, I know. You can keep the old one, but you want a new one. There's a huge amount of stress that happens for lottery winners immediately. Once they have outed themselves, it's extremely stressful. I've talked to lottery winners from their hospital beds, people that were thriving, people part of a, one was a police officer. So he had a great job, a great life, and he ended up in the hospital for stress. 2 weeks, that's a long time.
Because all the relatives calling, asking for something, something,
something.
The church,
he started to make offers or indications that, you know, he was going to help people, which is a lovely first statement. And you really have to watch your commitments. So it was people connected to the church, it was people connected to the family. And then when you transfer, when you go to collect money, they don't give you a check. You transfer the money to an account that you already have set up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people don't have the sophistication to have, you know, brokerage accounts and private bankers and that sort of thing. So typically, it would go to the bank that they have their checking account with. And when this kind of money goes into the average bank, all kinds of bells and whistles go off, so people are after you. All different departments of the bank, now you're the top of their list. And this poor guy that I'm mentioning to you, he did that. He transferred it to his bank, and it's a national bank. It's not a small local bank. And he could find no peace. He basically
they had so many services to sell him suddenly.
Yeah, and you know, he hadn't had time. This was his first week. Yeah. He hadn't had time to think about it. And so what we want people to do is to pull back a little bit. You know, if you had a perfect world, you would give yourself some retreat time where you stay anonymous, you don't let the cat out of the bag locally, and you have time to really step back and think about it. And we ask people when we do that kind of work, we ask some questions like, what matters to you? What do we need to protect in your life? What's important now and in the past and in the future? So it's not like, how do I save taxes and how do I get the best return or buy the biggest house? That's noise in the head, and they're important, and you get to it. But you start out on the personal side. What does this really mean right now? And what would you like it to mean 5 years, 10 years from now? You have those conversations first, and then you back into the details.
Are you immediately in trouble? Our caller, Masha, her first thought is, I can't go on the subway anymore. I need a limo. But then I can't trust my driver. Is the first thing you have to do hire security?
Well, remember, you're not the first wealthy person in the world, so there are people ahead of you who have figured things like that out, and there are agencies and there are services. If you land with the right company and the right advisor team, it's a team. There isn't any one person, so we call it a brain trust, like your board of advisors, and someone on that team might be the security person. And so there are people who have thought it out. So you can live a very nice life, but you do have to watch out a little bit more than you did before.
Michael Hiltzik, I was struck. I was reading somewhere here that if you should take the whole thing, even if it was a billion, you know, you don't get all of it, but even with this huge money, there are 100-plus other Americans who will make just as much in 2016 as you would if you're the winner of this. It's not as though you're the only rich person in this country, as Susan says, Michael.
Well, that's true, and not only are there many others who make as much, but there are some of them, including, look, Mark Cuban is a guy who basically won the lottery by selling his company for, you know,
huge
millions,
sum.
I think $1 billion. And in fact, people who know Mark Cuban probably say that he didn't change at all when he won. He's still the same character that we knew when he had nothing.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, You should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Super Lottery prize on the table right now, the $1.5 billion Powerball jackpot, the dreams, the craziness, and psychology of the national a frenzy around it right now, the good, the bad, the ugly, the funny, and what to do if you win it. Susan Bradley is with us from the Sudden Money Institute. She can advise you on this right here, right now, because, of course, we have all, anybody who's bought a ticket has imagined that you are or will be a winner. What's the conversation like at your house with your friends when you think, what if, and is this fun, or are we too into Powerball? Michael Hiltzik with us as well from the Los Angeles Times, business columnist there. Frank Fairley is with us, former president of the American Psychological Association, professor of psychology at Temple University, and lots of callers lined up here. Maybe winners, maybe winners. Ken in Ticonderoga, New York. Ken, you're on the air.
Tom, Frank, Michael, Suzanne, hey. No fear here. If you can't justify throwing the equivalent of a she cup of coffee at a couple of tickets for a chance at, albeit long odds, 300 million to one, you got to balance that against the fact that infinity is the odds if you don't buy a ticket.
You can't win if you don't play. That's the old saw, Ken, and you're buying it.
Yeah, two tickets. Come on.
Okay. Buying the dream there, at least for the time it takes to find out what the result is. Thank you, Ken. Daniel in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Daniel, you're on.
Hey, Tom, and great panel. You know, you guys convinced me. I stopped in my track. I'm in my car, and I bought five tickets.
Oh, no, Daniel, that wasn't our purpose. We didn't come to convince you. But I guess you can't talk about it without it getting the bug.
Exactly. You know, and you did convince me in the sense that it's someone's got to win it. And why not? You know, I never play the lottery, and someone is going to win it, and it could be me. So I've already promised money to the guy who sold me the tickets and to family and a whole bunch of people.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, we wish you good luck, but I don't know what to make of that. Michael, do we all become complicit just by talking about it?
Well, look, I don't want to be moralistic about it. And sure, and I think what the caller just said is very indicative of the way most people deal with it. Look, there's no reason not to. You don't want to avoid it. And in fact, the lotteries are very carefully set up so that the point of sale is very easy. You know, when you walk into when you're at a supermarket checkout, the impulse buys are always at the checkout counter because they know how to get your last few bucks. I think the lottery sales are pretty much the same way. They're there at the checkout at a convenience store or wherever. So it's an easy buy. And yeah, I think the caller is right. When the number is this big, there's, it's a flyer. As I said, it's painless. It's frictionless. Most people who come out of the woodwork to buy tickets when the jackpot is this large are not habitual players. They're impulse players. They will play this game. And when the jackpot reverts down to a couple of hundred million or wherever it starts, they're not going to play. And I think the lottery people know that, and they know that now that they've set a high bar at a billion and a half, it may be hard to get a lot of people to keep playing when the jackpot is only in the mid nine figures.
Susan, I want to get back to you to plan what I'm going to do with my winnings here, or for Daniel, who wins around the corner from you in Florida. But Frank Farley, first to you here, think therapeutically for a minute. Is this all right, the fun we have with this? Where's the line where it becomes a problem? If you put a lottery ticket buyer on the couch, what are you poking around for to find out if this is an unhealthy obsession? Or, I mean, $2 is cheaper than going to a movie. If it gives you a day of fantasy, maybe that's not so bad.
I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, this is the ultimate Hail Mary pass, and it's cheap and it's fun. And where else for $2 do you have even the remotest chance of turning your life around? So it's not that bad. We always look at whether some behavior is interfering with your life. You know, is it interfering with your family life, your work life, etc.? And, you know, getting involved in this particular Powerball certainly doesn't seem to meet that criterion, so I'm not worried about it.
I mean, what if I'm dropping, you know, a significant percentage of my income? Lower-income Americans, the studies find, do that.
That's different. And yes, I mean, as a proportion against income, when it gets to be as high as some of those cases, you know, that can interfere with your life. And your you know, sure, survival, your work life, your family life, and everything else, that's when it becomes a problem. And maybe the couch is something that, you know, you should consider. That is to get your behavior, to change your behavior on this front.
Susan, you're in the money game. Can you see a situation in which people are less optimistic about actually making good in this economy and so get more interested in the long shot of a lottery win?
Yeah, we actually look at anticipation as the first stage of a financial transition, and that's usually like anticipating retirement or an inheritance and things like that. And it can lower your intentions to save because you think there's this big payoff coming down the road. So the anticipation of a lottery win actually could be detrimental. And I'm sure that does happen with some people. It might deprive them of some other motivations to take care of things.
Hey, walk us through the numbers, Susan, because again, we're all thinking about, you know, the big pot that we're going to win. They say $1.5 billion, but of course, it's only that if you take it over 30 years, right?
Right. And, you know, this is gambling income. It's taxed as ordinary income. It's taxed on the federal, state, county, city in some cases. But whatever the number is, what we find is that there are really five categories that this money goes to. When I sit with a lottery winner, they're usually sleep deprived. They generally are nervous and happy. They've got euphoria. They're kind of feeling like they don't want to blow it. There are enough bad stories out there. But then they will eventually say to me, but what do I actually do with the money? And the money usually gets divided into five categories. One is creating your lifestyle or supporting your lifestyle. Another is family. Another is investing for income if you've taken the lump sum. The other is to invest for growth for the future. And then the other is charitable giving or sharing and that in whatever order is important to people. But it helps people compartmentalize the money. And then when you start to divide it into these five different buckets, if you will, you've got tax, you've got legal, you've got lots of things to learn about each one, but we can address them one at a time, and it makes it more manageable. It still takes a couple of months before we have somebody ready to actually claim. You know, that's the thing you want people to do. You want them to go under the radar, take a breath, and start to assemble their team and figure things out. Looking at these five buckets helps people start to feel what it's going to be like. And hopefully we manage some of the commitments they're making, like committing to share the money with a guy that sold you the ticket. You know, I'm sure he's not going to hold you to it. But you want to be careful of all the commitments. Saying we won versus I won is a big deal in many families.
What's your out-of-the-gate advice here? Because, again, we're all trying to figure out exactly what we're going to be doing on Thursday morning. Annuity, take it over 30 years or lump sum?
You know, I have pros and cons on both. I know if you strictly stick to the numbers, you can make a really strong case that you end up net-net with more money taking the annuity.
It's $18 million a year or something like that with this huge pot.
Yeah.
That seems like it might be enough.
People have a tendency to overspend because they get their check once a year, so it's not like a monthly income or biweekly or something. So what happens is I have seen more people get into trouble with the annuity payout than I have with the lump sum. And I know that sounds counterintuitive.
Why? How?
Well, because they're thinking of themselves as having, you know, they now won this 1.5. So that's what they're worth, 1.5. And it's not really true. We all know that, but it's installments. So somebody goes out and they start to live large, and towards the end of the year, they start to run out of money. So then they run up some debt to cover them for the last 3 months of the year. So they start the next year in the hole a bit. It doesn't matter in the first couple of years because you've got plenty of money still coming in. But by the fifth year is where people start to show some strain on that. And there are many investor, that's kind of a loose term.
Yeah.
There are companies that will go after people who want to sell, pre-sell certain years of their income.
Right,
and
right.
That's a real losing game.
$18 million a year, and already you got me in trouble 5 years out. Holy smokes.
Yeah, it can happen. It can happen. So the answer to annuity or lump sum is it depends. Neither one of them is a sure bet, and both of them can pay off beautifully. So you just got to work through it.
We've got Kate writing to us online here. My husband is convinced he doesn't want to win because that much money is a burden and too much responsibility. She says, I disagree. We've got another listener says, my first open statement, I will help myself, I will help my circle, and if you're going to ask, the answer is no. Jason in Virginia Beach, Virginia, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Jason.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay. Are you winning, Jason? Yeah. Are you thinking you might?
Yeah, I just play for fun. I might spend $50, maybe $100 in a year playing lottery stuff, and it's just random. But the way I look at it is, even if I don't win, I'm contributing to somebody else getting a great life. So it's just fun for me, and when somebody wins and it's not me, I'm just like, all right, cool, I helped out that person. And it's just, you're contributing in some way, and it's just a wonderful thing. And hopefully one day I do pick something up, but doesn't really matter.
Vicarious thrills in somebody else's splendid win there. You're a big man, Jason. Carter in Nashville, Tennessee. Carter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think, Carter?
Well, I very, very rarely play the lottery. I don't think I ever played the Powerball before, but, I've been reading about it or listening to something about it, and I was thinking about it and looking at this construction dumpster with numbers on it, and I was like, oh, what the heck? Let's play it. But my question,
so you took your numbers off a construction dumpster. All right. There's the formula. Why not? It's as good as anything else, Carter.
Who knows?
Okay, so if you win, is your life turned upside down tomorrow?
So, and that has a lot to do with my question for your commenters, people who have studied this industry and know more about previous, winners of big jackpots. I'm sure it would be a lot to manage and a big change, but where I am in life right now, I'm in nursing school.
Good.
And I have some other colleagues who, have also bought a ticket. And I was sort of distressed to hear some of them say, oh, yeah, no, I'll drop out tomorrow if I win the lottery. And I was like, well, I would still want to be a nurse. I just wouldn't need to worry about what the job would pay or, anything having to do with money as far as choosing where to serve. And some of the teachers, were on both sides of the fence as well. Would they just quit doing what they were doing and serving communities that way? So I guess my question is, do any of your commenters who have worked with big jackpot winners or anything like that, do they have examples of people who viewed their job as a calling or something they still wanted to do? And I guess thinking about that lady who worked at the fiberglass factory, I bet she loved her coworkers and maybe really liked her boss, but she probably just wasn't super passionate about, working on an assembly line. But for people that have worked hard.
Yeah. Carter, we've got it. You're in nursing school. It feels like a calling to you. I've spent some time in fiberglass factories. That's tough work. I might be out of there as well, but Susan, what about it? I've heard people say all kinds of things. Some say, I'd be out of here in a nanosecond. Others say, no, I'd stick with my work. Is there a track record you can see?
Yeah. Real life is that if you're one of these winners now, the spotlight is so strong following your life, it would be hard to continue in nursing school right now. But you can't make a good life out of just numbers. You need to make a good life out of purpose and passion and connectivity and socialization and all of that. So what I would say is maybe you step back, and it is a lot of work the first year, particularly there's a lot of legal and accounting and philanthropy and conversation with vocabulary you've never had before. So it's a bit spinning in the beginning. But once you get that down, I would go right back into nursing school and under the radar, so you don't have to talk about, your lottery win. You might do it in a different community if you've really been celebrated in your local community, but you go right back into the life of meaning. And maybe you use your winnings to support nursing schools, and you do many different things connected to that that you couldn't otherwise do. And you work with people to help you make the most of your money to contribute to things that make you feel purposeful. Otherwise, the money by itself is really more detrimental than positive. But if you can build community, family, and you have some real meaning around it, it can be fantastic. You just might not be exactly the same person as you were before, but your core values, the core of you, should stay the same.
Good luck with that, Carter, the nurse in the Ferrari or the nurse who builds the new nursing school. Michael Hiltzik, when I imagine the amount of fantasizing that goes on around this, I almost wonder about national productivity here. If all of that mental energy were put into, I don't know, the next generation of alternative fuels, maybe we'd be better off, Michael.
Well, you know, we do a lot of things in this country, and we do a lot of things as human beings that somebody or other is going to think of as a waste. I mean, you know that at the time of March Madness every year, there's a firm that comes out and says, American workers are squandering billions of dollars by doing their brackets. Look, it's all part of life, and I think this money, you know, we all have our self-image, and we know what we want to do with our lives, and I don't think there are that many people who think the only thing they want to do with their lives, as my fellow panelist said, is have money. Money is always an end, a means to some end. And I think that's the way a lot of people think of it. Look, if you like what you do, if you think of your job as a calling, then you might use a win like this as a way to pursue that calling or to control your ability to pursue it in some way. So it takes all kinds. I think Powerball, it's a passing fancy because at some point somebody's going to win this jackpot, and then we reset the clock. I'm sure it's not really taking away from the economy in any material sense.
Well, psychosis or passing fancy, it all keeps rolling. Michael Hiltzik with the LA Times, Susan Bradley at the Sudden Money Institute, Frank Farley at Temple University. We're so grateful to all of you. Good luck, everybody. This is On Point.